How do you process something bad, something scary or hard? Now that we live in an increasingly connected digital world, do you seek out other people online who feel the same way? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Today, we're going to look at how we cope after something like the Orlando tragedy happens, and at some of the other ways we connect, to talk about things like kids and money and how to teach life lessons. Plus, we're asking what a corporation means and who it's obligated to. Consumers? Workers? Shareholders? We're continuing our Marketplace series, The Price of Profits. As always, come connect and share your thoughts with us at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. We are starting today by thinking about the way we deal with news, like last weekend's shooting in Orlando. Since the mission of this show is where the economy meets real life, we wanted to know how our evolving digital economy and the rise of companies like Facebook, Twitter, even crowdfunding sites fits into this. So we brought on Karen North, a professor at USC and an expert in psychology and social media. I asked her how this new connected digital world has changed the way we process tragic events.
It's interesting because in life we always look for thought leaders and we also look for groups to join so that we feel like we have camaraderie in our opinions. And social media now allows us to find that not just at the workplace or at school, but instead we can go seek it out on social media and we have a world of people that might provide us with those opportunities to bond with people over opinions.
When we look at social media as a connective tool, it's also sort of a fractious one. I mean, I'm thinking about the Wall Street Journal has this experiment of red and blue Facebook news feeds. And it does make me wonder how much connection we get, but also how much siloing we reinforce.
People psychologically seek out information and opinions that confirm their own opinions. It's just a natural state of being. And the internet has allowed us to seek out people who already agree with us and to bolster our opinions. You know, the reality is that the people who have skewed opinions still have to get their news from somewhere. And so the general news comes from the traditional media, and then the bloggers and podcasters and the people who share their opinions on social networks are really reacting almost like commentary. So there's still a huge burden or a huge responsibility on traditional journalists to present both sides of controversial issues.
Yeah, I want to get your take on one other question, I guess, of journalistic responsibility in a mass tragedy event, and particularly with mass shootings, this question of should people be named, should their pictures be out there, suspects, I mean, you know, really divides journalists. I tend to think that news is news, but I wonder what the research shows about how media reinforces narratives in these cases.
Well, frankly, I find that personalizing the individuals who commit heinous acts is a dangerous practice. We've seen it. We've seen similar things happen with things like school shootings after Columbine in particular. We saw that. And what it really is, there, some people talk about it as contagion or emotional contagion. And the danger is that people look for people who are similar to themselves. And it's not that people necessarily copycat what other people have done, but it becomes a plausible behavioral response.
What do you think is a responsible way then for news organizations or people who want to share these things with their friends?
I don't know. And there's a really fine line between what you should do as a journalism to report all of the information and what you should do as a socially responsible member of our community. And I think that to some extent, we all want to know who are these people who do these things.
Yeah, it's sort of a human impulse.
It's a human impulse. We want to understand it. And the thing about the digital age is that we now also are drawn to want to sort of be there vicariously and see what happened and how it happened and why it happened. Now, the first thing that people want to see is they want to see the iPhone video from inside of Pulse or from inside of whatever it is. And it's us trying to figure it out and master the situation. And it's all of us wanting to have a personal experience rather than just hearsay or news reports. But at the same time, to the extent that we humanize the people who do terrible things, then we all realize that there's a part of them that hurts in the way that we hurt. And for very troubled people, it's frightening to think how much they might identify with those people.
Because it seems like digital technology and communication really does close the gap for, say, a disaffected person who's looking for an ideology, any ideology to latch onto.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, we, you know, you can go back for decades and look at things like social learning theory and modeling and how people, even very young children, are drawn to try to understand their feelings and attribute their feelings and find a behavioral response. It's the same digital environment that allows all of us to care about the victims or the people who are hurt by those people.
Right.
We've never had the capacity or the opportunity to feel such empathy or to join in and help support people who are hurting the way that we have today. The idea of being able to raise money for people who are faced with horrible financial burdens is a phenomenal outgrowth of it. But the other thing is that there are people who don't realize how many people care or might care about them. And there's an opportunity for people to share their concern for people they've never met. And, you know, ultimately in the world, that's a positive message.
Karen North, director of USC Annenberg's Digital Social Media Program, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Now to our regular feature, Long and Short. That's when we borrow a couple of words from the world of finance and ask our guests to go long or short to bet on or against some topics in the world of news and business. This week, we have Jillian White, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, and Marketplace's own Andy Euler. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Let's start with a long here. Andy, why don't you go first? What are you long?
I know despite what everybody thinks about what's happening in Mexico and even the politics of America affecting Mexico as well, I think I'm long on Mexico, and a lot of it boils down to deregulation of the energy industry. And I think it's moving a lot faster than we initially anticipated. You know, we talked about Pemex opening up and oil companies coming in and essentially trying to figure out what they can exploit in Mexico.
So this is long Mexico's economic future?
Exactly.
Then?
I think I'm long on Mexico just in terms of opening up its economy and Mexico generally speaking. I know that we're supposed to be very short on the peso right now because it's, you know, over the last 3 or 4 months, it's been devalued quite a bit. I'm not trading pesos, so I don't have to really worry about that. But I'm long on Mexico right now.
I'm going to support that long, but only for the reason that poor Mexico. I just feel like in so many ways they cannot catch a break right now. On top of the devaluing of the peso, you know, banks are talking about shorting the peso, depending on what our political situation is.
Yes, that's the Donald Trump hedge from a couple of Wall Street banks,
right.
Huh?
Yeah, so I'm going to support that long just because I'm rooting for Mexico.
Okay, well, let's stay, I guess, in the sort of Latin American economy sector. And Jillian, why don't you give me your short?
So my short is debating the PROMESA, it's basically the Puerto Rico rescue bill that has passed the House and would have to pass the Senate in order to give Puerto Rico a little bit of debt relief. It would stave off their payments for a while, and it would also create an oversight board to help them determine what to do. I know that tenets of the PROMESA bill are actually very controversial, and Andy, I think you can talk about this a little bit more.
Very dangerous, dangerous territory to get me started on Puerto Rico right now.
Well, because you've been covering Puerto Rico,
for about a year. If you talk to anybody on the island, they don't like what's happening with the bill, and they actually don't think it's going to really go anywhere. But at the same time, they just lost a Supreme Court case this week that would have allowed them to restructure utilities. And so they have to look to Congress. They're in really bad shape. So I agree with you. I'm short. I don't really think it's a solution, but I don't know what they're going to do if this doesn't work.
Well, because hanging over all of this, we have the question of whether they default on July 1st. A lot of big payments are due.
$2 billion.
Exactly. So that's my concern. I understand that, you know, this is a controversial bill and that there's not a lot of support and that it doesn't necessarily sit well with the people of Puerto Rico. But I also just fear what happens if July 1st hits and we have no plan and the debt isn't getting restructured and they're looking at lights being off and hospitals being shuttered. And, you know, that seems like a humanitarian crisis to me, and I'm really concerned about it.
Well, and if you're Puerto Ricans and you're complaining about sovereignty and you're complaining about, you know, kind of being a colony of the United States still, you can have that argument over and over, and we've been having it for years. But you're right. We got to figure something out. And I think this bill, you know, it's kind of one of those deals where it's like, this is what we got, and we got to go with it.
I want to flip to sports now. Jillian, give me your long.
Yeah, so my long is strong collective bargaining agreements for female athletes, specifically for the women's national soccer team of the United States. I'm sure lots of folks have already heard. The team has filed a lawsuit with the EEOC alleging wage discrimination. And there's a lot of complexity to that. There are a lot of reasons that U.S. Soccer says that men and women get paid differently. They also argue that the gap isn't as big as the women have claimed, that it's actually only about 2% among players who rank in the top 25. But the fact of the matter is, there is a gap, and the women are way, way, way more successful than the men.
Yeah.
It's totally wage discrimination.
Yeah. And, well, they say, you know, that the women in their collective bargaining agreement opt for higher salaries for more stability instead of more of a pay-for-play type arrangement, which is what the men have. And also they say that part of the issue is that FIFA is really the determining factor based on their prize money. So, for instance, for winning the World Cup last year, the women got $2 million. For getting knocked out in the round of 16, the men got $9 million.
Wow.
So it's crazy. It's totally unfair. But there are smaller things like per diems and sponsor appearances for which the women are getting paid less than the men. And that is totally within U.S. Soccer's control. And the difference there is that the men recently renegotiated their collective bargaining agreement and asked for a bump. And the women actually haven't renegotiated their collective bargaining agreement since it expired in 2012. They have a continuance, essentially, that kind of holds over all of those old rules. So they'll be negotiating during 2016, and this is really a time for them to, if they have a strong CBA, kind of get some of that equity and some of those changes and even some just quality of play issues like artificial turf, which, you know, can cause greater injuries and things like that.
A lot of injuries,
some of that
stuff
changed.
Marketplace's Andy Euler and Jillian White from The Atlantic, thank you both very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Lizzie. That was fun.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary.
Brexit, the upcoming UK decision on whether or not to leave the European Union, is something we discussed, and I think it's fair to say that it was one of the factors that factored into today's decisions.
And that is Fed Chair Janet Yellen talking about one of the reasons the Fed did not raise interest rates this week. They're worried about the potential impact of a Brexit. Britain votes next week whether to stay in or leave the EU. Polls indicate it could go either way. With the help of our partners at the BBC, we're going to look at some of the issues surrounding the Brexit vote. We're going to start with a contentious one, fishing. The BBC's Martha Dixon reports.
I'm walking down a pier in the far west of the UK, fishing boats all around me. Beyond here, the Atlantic Ocean and ripe seas, fished by locals since the 15th century. But in the 1980s, the European Union took control and gave equal access to these seas to all its member states. And that's made fishermen like James Roberts angry. He's tying up after coming back from laying nets a few miles offshore. James says it's hard to make a living because of EU rules. Foreign boats can come to local grounds, and he's only allowed to catch a certain amount of fish. He's voting for Britain to leave the EU in next week's referendum.
I'm angry at the current system at the minute in the EU because of the French allowed to fish up to our coastal waters. I, as an English fisherman, feel I can't go beyond a certain distance because I'll be destroyed with Frenchmen towed through my own nets. And currently the quota system at the minute, I'm one in every 2 weeks tied up ashore at the minute where I could be catching haddocks, which I'm not allowed to, but yet French fishing boats can come on our limits or our shores and catch those very fish I'm not allowed to catch.
In the narrow streets of this picturesque town, the complaints of local fishermen make an emotive case, influencing many voters in next week's referendum.
I'm voting out, and the reason I'm voting out is to vote for our fishing industry.
Absolutely support fishermen. I think for myself personally, I go a week, I look at all the evidence, 1 week I'm in, the next week I'm out. One thing I don't understand is why we can't stay in but negotiate what we need for our fishermen.
But despite this very vocal feeling here to leave the EU, not all fishermen want out.
Morning, calling Fish Producer Organisation.
That's in right, a nearby yeah, office correct, overlooking yeah. the harbour, Paul Trebilcock very, heads a group representing all those yeah. who fish in this very, county's yeah. several ports.
If you were to walk down the quay, there is, an overwhelming majority who would be talking about voting to leave Europe. 30 years of frustration, 30 years of anger with what Europe and the common fisheries policy has done to them. Interestingly, there is a smaller, quieter minority, those perhaps who fish more in other member state waters, who rely more on export markets, who I think will end up or are considering to vote to remain. They seem to be quieter. I don't know, maybe because they're in the minority, because the majority is a louder voice.
In an effort to manage these waters and conserve fish stocks, the EU tells each country how much fish it can catch. This is the fish quota. But if Britain votes to leave the EU, there's no guarantee fishermen here will get a better share. New agreements will have to be forged. And environmentalists say without the EU, the fishing industry as a whole would be in a much worse state. The fishing community has a strong voice in the southwest of England. There are also big ports in the north of the country and Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. The fishermen may not swing the vote, but those who want to leave the EU are definitely banging the drum much louder than those who want to stay.
If the UK votes to leave the European Union, the only land border it will have with the EU will be in Ireland. That was partitioned after the Irish War of Independence nearly 100 years ago. Northern Ireland remains in the UK and has largely recovered from the sectarian conflict which lasted from the 1960s until the turn of the century. But the Brexit debate has brought up a lot of old scars. BBC Ireland correspondent Chris Page has been following the referendum campaign there.
This is BBC Radio Ulster.
On BBC local radio, the former British minister with responsibility for Northern Ireland, Lord Mandelson, had this warning about what could happen if Britain were to leave the European Union.
That's going only to serve the extremists, those who foment the sectarianism that breeds violence.
But does anybody here agree that a British exit from Europe would endanger the hard-won peace? Arlene Foster, the leader of the Democratic Unionist Party, is First Minister of Northern Ireland. She's campaigning for a so-called Brexit.
You could either look at it in terms of fear and worry, or you can look at it as an opportunity. And my politics tends to be in relation to hope and opportunity and positivity. I don't think the European Union determines the relationships that we have with the government in the Republic of Ireland, and we will continue to have those good relations.
Unionists like Arlene Foster want to keep Northern Ireland within the UK. Nationalists believe Northern Ireland should be joined with the Republic. The conflict over that dispute lasted 30 years, but ended with a peace agreement in 1998. Northern Ireland remained in the UK, but with its own power-sharing administration, with responsibility for most government affairs.
It is our position that Ireland's place, north and south, is in Europe.
Martin McGuinness is Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland. He's in the largest nationalist party, Sinn Féin. He doesn't think a Brexit would reignite sectarian violence, but he does believe it would cause problems.
It just creates so many economic and physical barriers. I just find it totally unacceptable.
In fact, it's those potential economic barriers which are causing more concern.
Well, I'm standing on an international frontier. I have one foot in County Tyrone, which is in Northern Ireland, part of the UK, and the other foot in County Donegal, in the Republic of Ireland. The only sign that you're crossing from one country into another is the road markings. There are no customs posts, no passport checks, no barriers. So would this almost invisible border become prominent again if the UK voted to leave the European Union? Peter Doherty is one of many business people on the UK side of the border who do trade with the Republic. He makes furniture for customers in both countries.
My worries are simple. Our catchment area is about a 30-mile radius, and if this go ahead and they leave, for example, I reckon that our business area will just be halved by such because of the inconvenience that it will cause. Nobody seems to know what's going to happen. Will they come back to custom post? This town depends so much on Donegal trade, and if we lose that, this town's finished.
Surveys of business people suggest most in Northern Ireland don't want the UK to come out of the EU. But some do see advantages in leaving.
It's anti-democratic. It's friendly for big business, big banks, and big politicians.
Trevor Mealiff runs a restaurant in Strabane.
The small to medium-sized businesses, it's been stifled by over-regulation and all these European rules and directives. There's a lot of scaremongering on the stay campaign about borders and border control being set up and one thing or another, but in this modern day, we don't really need to go back to having physical borders.
The Europe question is not generating any major tensions between the two communities who were at war for so many years. The debate here is focusing on the economy and trade. Northern Ireland has only 3% of the UK's population, but mainly because of the border, the results of the referendum will arguably affect this region more than most others.
The BBC's Chris Page. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Last week, we asked you to weigh in on the advice you've given your kids about money. Some of you focused on passing on the lessons you've learned. Jonathan Gray in Banning, California, learned a hard one from something he wants his kids to avoid.
A lesson I learned in my early 20s, I bought a car that I was barely able to afford. So when I lost my job at the time, I couldn't make the car payment out of my standard salary, so I had to fall back on credit cards. Eventually, the credit card money ran out, and I ended up losing the car. Shortly after, though, I found a new job, and I started rebuilding my credit, paying off my credit cards. And when they get older, yes, I want to teach them, don't buy something you can barely afford. You know, buy something that you can afford should something bad happen to you.
Yeah, yeah. Have that kind of some wiggle room, I guess, built in.
Yes.
Are there lessons that you learned from your parents that have changed the way you think about money? And are any of those things you want to pass on to your kids?
Growing up, my dad always told me, save your money, save your money, save your, like, this, all pretty much all he said. He never told me how to save my money. Now that I'm an adult and going to be teaching my kids about money as they grow up, I want to tell them how to save money. When they get that first job, I want to tell them, hey, you know, set aside a little bit of money, save it, but don't just put it in your savings account. You know, you want to spread it out. You want to put it into a CD account. You want to buy, you know, some entry-level stocks. You know, there's dollar stocks out there they can get into. And you know, do things like that so that that way they can invest their money.
Elsa Maria Lorenzo from Frisco, Texas, used her economics degree and background in banking to teach her teenagers.
I think really it's kind of a lifelong thing. You know, they would see how I would spend money, and I wasn't shy about telling them, no, we can't buy that right now. So I was pretty open about my own finances. And then once they got to be really around 13, they were able to get their own checking accounts. They had their own savings accounts, but then they managed their money with their debit card, and they knew to, you know, check it to see, okay, do I have the money before buying something? And certainly mobile banking has made that a million times easier.
How did you teach them about credit?
Well, it really came from my experience as a banker and seeing how it affected people's lives. So I would see that if somebody was coming in to get a car loan and their credit was bad, they were going to pay a lot for it. And so I just started realizing that it was much more expensive to live if you had poor credit. And so it was just conversations that I would have. I would come home and, you know, certainly wouldn't reveal any privacy, but I would come home and have those conversations about what I ran into at work. When they turned 18, I added them onto my credit cards so that they could start building credit. So they don't actually use my card. It's my credit that is building their credit.
Hmm. Is that something you'd recommend for other parents?
Oh, absolutely. It was actually a banker that I worked with that she was older that gave me that advice. And I thought, oh, my gosh, what a great idea. So, yeah, absolutely. It's a great way to help them build credit.
Then we turn to Doug McCormick. He's the author of the book Family Inc. and a father of two. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
I think a lot of parents wonder when they should start teaching kids about money and whether money even needs to be a concept at that point, or you can work these things in really early.
You know, first of all, I would say I teach my kids that they're owners throughout life of their labor. And so if you think about it in that framework, it's never too early to start. And I think the key is that you make it age appropriate and interesting so they can be engaged in the conversation. At a very early age, I got my kids used to the concept of they were going to be contributing members of the household. So they would do certain chores around the house and in return get an allowance that they could choose to spend as they wanted to.
You have a son and a daughter, correct?
I do.
And what's worked with them?
Well, I'll tell you, the one that's probably I've had the most fun with is getting them involved in investing with the stock market. And, you know, this is actually a very longstanding family tradition. My dad bought for me my first stock when I was 7, and I've continued that tradition. So every year at Christmas time, I buy my kids a little bit of stock in something that they get to choose. And that's the really neat part about it. So this is not necessarily about it being a good investment. It's about having them have an opportunity to be empowered investors, having them feel connected to what they bought. So as you can imagine, if a youth is making those kind of choices, we own things like Apple and Google and Chipotle. And that has been a lot of fun because it's allowed them to have conversations with me about what happens to those stocks over time. And I think it also allows them to relate to the product. So my son decided to buy Chipotle because he liked it. And you can't imagine how much he goes there now, and he feels like an owner every time he goes. So it's been a lot of fun.
You know, a lot of these concepts, say buying a stock, they're somewhat sophisticated. Let's say you're listening to this and, you know, that has not been a part of your life. How do you equip your child with these skills, maybe if you haven't experienced them yourself?
It's a great question. I think the good news about the way the financial markets evolved are these products are becoming more and more readily available. And so I'm a big believer in low-cost passive investing, and there are lots of investment firms that provide those kind of products. So Vanguard, Fidelity, Charles Schwab, those kind of organizations are very easy to get online, learn about the products, and with very small dollars, get invested and begin to learn about it.
You know, we're at the start of summer. There are different ways that parents choose to have their kids spend a summer. When do you think is a good time to have a summer job? And what should the conversation be around that job?
So not to be repetitive, but I'll go back to, I think as early as possible. And I somewhat relate this to my own experiences. I lived and grew up in a rural environment where I was working on a farm by the age of 10. And so that experience to me was very valuable, not just in terms of a chance to earn money, but there's so many valuable skills that come along with that summer job experience. It's accountability. It's learning to interview. It's the self-confidence and self-esteem that comes with that experience. So, you know, candidly, as I've now lived in a more urban environment, I think those kind of opportunities are less available to young folks. But I think the opportunity to engage at as early a level as possible is really helpful. I think in urban areas, I've found community service to be a pretty good substitute. There's not the same financial element, but I think you get a lot of the important skills out of the experience.
You know, one of the big tensions I think a lot of parents face is the degree to which to let their children screw up. And a lot of people screw up with money in varying ways.
How much independence do you think a child should have, and when do you want to catch them?
So I guess at first I'd say I think every kid is different, so I'm not sure there are any tried and true rules here. I know in my own experience, my son and my daughter could not be more different about their approaches to money. My son is a live-for-the-moment kind of guy as a older teenager, and you know, pretty much spends it as fast as he can get it. My daughter's got the next 20 years planned out. So I think I say that because I think it's dangerous to say there's a one-size, you know, kind of fits-all approach to it. But I think, you know, every time I see my kids make a mistake with money, I actually think it's a wonderful thing. And the reason is simply this. The mistakes they make today are going to be a lot less costly than the mistakes they'll make in the future. So I'm a big proponent of finding ways for them to make many small mistakes. So I think within boundaries, giving them as much opportunity to fail and then having that opportunity as a teaching moment is tremendous.
So that maybe that comes on owing a tiny little debt as opposed to, say, your first credit card.
Yeah. So I think, for example, where I've seen lots of failure is around budgeting at a young age. So, you know, we have this allowance concept. I've done things like giving the kids money to go do their school shopping. And I've done things like giving kids money to their summer allowance for the entire summer and watched my son spend 3 months worth of summer allowance in 3 weeks, but then deal with the consequences for the next 2 months. And so I think those kind of experiences are real helpful.
Doug McCormick, thank you so much for your time.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Next week, we continue our conversation about teaching kids how to deal with money. What lessons have you handed down? Did they work? And what's the best advice you ever got? Go to marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or call us. We're 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be used on the air. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. Maybe on our show, you've heard the phrase shareholder value. That's the idea that public corporations are obligated to put the interest of stockholders before employees, customers, and everything else. It's a fairly common understanding now that their only job, in other words, is to maximize profits for anyone who holds a piece of that company. But it wasn't always this way. As part of the Marketplace series, The Price of Profits, Scott Tong explains how we got here.
It all began with a professor. At the University of Chicago, economist Milton Friedman wrote this in 1970. There is one and only one social responsibility of business, to increase its profits. For whom? For stockholders, he wrote. This was a brand new idea that took, because the old corporate model was crumbling under pressure from inflation and from weak growth. Rick Wortsman of the Drucker Institute is the author of The End of Loyalty, coming out this year.
Some called it slumpflation. Inflump was another one that circulated. But most famously was stagflation.
It exposed American companies as uncompetitive.
Many companies had gotten fat and lazy during the golden age of American business. We just didn't see the seams starting to come apart until the late 60s, early 70s.
Friedman and his Chicago colleagues argued that companies were taking on too many social responsibilities, providing jobs, helping to fight pollution, and end discrimination. It was inefficient.
We saw enormous amounts of waste going on.
Economist Mike Jensen was a student of Friedman's, and he co-wrote the most cited business paper ever. Shareholders suffered, he wrote, because executives were selfish. They wanted perks.
You can't ignore the self-interest of everybody that's involved, and you can't assume that firms maximize profits.
CEOs feathering their nests. Now, some of us of a certain vintage recall the 80s film Wall Street. It stars a rather obnoxious shareholder, Gordon Gekko, here talking to other shareholders.
You are all being royally screwed over by these bureaucrats with their steak lunches, their hunting and fishing trips, their corporate jets and golden parachutes.
Now, if you listen closely, Gordon Gekko is channeling his inner University of Chicago Mike Jensen. If you shape up executives, you shape up companies, and shareholders win.
Quite often, something that's significantly new and right, or basically right, is rejected by the profession because it's too new. But that all went away eventually. It caught on. It stuck.
Jensen went on to become a superstar prof at Harvard Business School, where his ideas went mainstream. David Langstaff was an MBA student then, before going on to run companies in national defense.
The dominant and the accepted understanding at the time, which continues, is that business is there to make a profit for shareholders, period.
So, into the 80s echo chamber, along with big hair and new Coke, went three business words.
Maximize shareholder value.
Mike Jensen may not have used those words, but that's how his ideas got applied by a whole generation of leaders, says Roger Martin. He's former management dean at the University of Toronto.
There was an obsession with shareholder value maximization as manifested in meeting your quarterly earnings so the analysts are all happy with you.
How happy? Stocks soared 12-fold in the 80s and 90s. For every $1 in profits, 80 cents went to shareholders through dividends and what are called buybacks. Which brings us to the rub. A fast way to fast profits is cutting jobs. Rick Wartzman of the Drucker Institute says what began to erode at this time is what he calls the corporate social contract.
That basically said, if you come to work every day and you work hard and you give the corporation a measure of loyalty, we in turn will take care of you, often for the rest of your life. All that changed.
Wages flattened. Pensions and healthcare benefits eroded.
This idea of maximizing shareholder value is an important reason why all that happened. There are other reasons. The rise of technology, globalization, the decline of unions. But I'd put it right up there with any of those other factors.
To many, the relevant case study here is General Electric in the 1980s, run by an old college hockey captain named Jack Welch. Now, GE in the 50s, like many companies then, made explicit that workers and research came first, shareholders last. But under Welch, it downsized more than 100,000 workers in 5 years, one of his strategies being to dump the lowest 10% of performers. Here's Welch at the MIT Sloan School of Business in 2005.
Okay, you know exactly who the turkeys are. And they're right amongst you. Baseball teams do it every day. It's the way it is. Why should business not have cuts?
Welch cut entire divisions and plants. He famously demanded that his managers fix it, sell it, or close it.
A lot of people initially were a little bit alarmed.
Nicholas Heyman of the investment bank William Blair is a long, long-time GE analyst, going all the way back to the 80s. He spoke by phone.
GE's actions spawned a lot more similar type of aggressive cost restructuring across industrial America in the late 80s and throughout the 90s.
Fair or not, Welch became the face of maximizing shareholder value, its winners and its losers. In his 2 decades at the helm, GE met Wall Street expectations almost every single quarter. A $14 billion company became a more than $400 billion behemoth. Welch himself made nearly $1 billion. So other executives followed, sometimes to be like him and sometimes out of fear. Because in the mid-80s, some testy shareholders with deep pockets started to buy out big companies and fire underperforming executives. There's accountability.
Another one bites the dust.
This all took on different names, from corporate raiders to today's activist investors, perhaps the most famous being Carl Icahn. Hedge fund manager Jeff Graham has written a book on these battles. It's called Dear Chairman.
If you're the CEO of a company, then you have to keep that stock up. There's a famous quote from Carl Icahn from the 1980s. You need to keep that stock up or someone will do it for you.
Shareholders first. It became gospel. But the question is it even in the scripture? Does the law require it? Cornell Law professor Lynn Stout is the author of The Shareholder Value Myth.
There is a widespread and completely erroneous belief out there that there's some sort of legal duty that corporate managers have to, quote, maximize profits or maximize shareholder value.
In Stout's view, the misplaced assumption comes from an old, old case that cites stockholders' interest. But to stay out of the weeds here, she argues it did not set precedent. By contrast,
you can just pick up the Supreme Court case Hobby Lobby decided just a few years ago, read the majority opinion where Justice Alito says, and I quote, "Modern corporate law does not require for-profit corporations to pursue profit at the expense of everything else."
Now, just to be clear, law professors still argue about this. But the point is, it's far from a legal given that companies have to make profits for shareholders. And yet, it became the law of the land. And to Stout, it led directly to some bad decisions. Enron, the BP oil spill, the financial crisis. Which brings us back to the man widely acclaimed as the intellectual father, Mike Jensen.
Is it happened exactly the way I wanted it to happen? Probably not.
Jensen says the shareholder focus in some cases went overboard.
And there's always going to be some people who take it too far and then cause damage.
He says focusing only on stocks and stockholders is a misreading of his scholarship. For the record, he wrote in 1990 that CEOs should, quote, do what is in the shareholders' best interest. Now, he says,
I wouldn't put shareholders at the center. I'm still unhappy about the situation where people end up thinking that shareholders are primary. They're our only bosses. No.
Still, maximizing shareholder value remains in fashion. In one study of the S&P 500 companies, the share of profits going to stockholders has gone from 50% in the early 80s to 86% in 2013, leaving an ever-shrinking pool of money to invest in the businesses themselves. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I now have the reporter who reported that story, Scott Tong, with me. He's been one of the drivers behind this Price of Profits series. Scott, welcome.
Hey, Lizzie.
So let's dig into some of this a little bit. We were just hearing about how sort of shareholder primacy has become the thing. And if we're in an era where shareholders have kind of become the top priority, what are the costs to making that happen?
I think it's good to think about this in terms of benefits and costs, because to be sure, you know, going back in history, the 70s and 80s showed us there certainly were benefits to focusing a little bit more on the shareholders and the companies. It certainly allowed a lot of American companies to become competitive. So I think we have to think about some of those benefits. And since then, there's been a lot of discussion about, well, it's also come with costs that we've seen since then. What kinds of costs? Some economists call these externalities, right? Cost to the environment with the BP oil spill. You know, a lot of people attribute some of that decision-making to the stock price and kind of immediate shareholder value. There are questions about the cost to the financial system with the subprime crisis and to worker security. There have been questions about the cost to customers. There's an example many cite of Campbell Soup. You know, as they tried to serve their shareholders, they took a lot of the chicken out of the chicken soup. So all different kinds of costs to kind of different people in the system, that if you put shareholders first, who comes behind that and who might be shortchanged here? A word that a lot more people use now is stakeholder capitalism. That is the idea of balancing interests of a lot of parties, a lot of constituents here.
Yes, this has become the trend, and it's even taught in business schools, but are there companies that don't do this?
Sure. A lot of companies have looked at, you know, what's happened with these publicly traded companies, and a lot of them have become no longer publicly traded. They've gone private, right? So that is one trend that we've seen. Companies that want to kind of make their own decisions, perhaps make longer-term decisions, have done that. And there are others that have said, you know, we're going to turn away at least a little bit from this, what many consider an obsession with shareholders, with the stock price, especially the quarterly meetings with analysts, quarterly earnings coming out to the public. The company Unilever, which is a Dutch Anglo company in Europe, has done away with this quarterly reporting. They don't come out every 3 months anymore and say, oh, we made, you know, this many pennies per share like most companies do. So you do see companies that are trying to focus on different or additional things.
Well, then does this mean that if you're a shareholder, either a regular person with, say, you know, stock in a 401k plan, or a great big shareholder, an activist like Carl Icahn, Dan Loeb, that you can say to a company executive, hey, you should listen to me about how to run your company?
Well, certainly. They've been described as the squeaky wheels of Wall Street. They have a lot of money. And what's interesting is
these activist investors.
These activist investors, these hedge funds that are very powerful, and a lot of the money actually comes from pension funds. And so they buy shares, and as a lot of people say, they start circling these companies or starting to tell them what to do. They have a lot of influence. They're very loud, and they sometimes want to break up companies or get rid of the board, change all the directors, or maybe have them merge with other companies. And one reason for that is because a lot of the rest of the investors are quiet and passive. Right? You and I, we have mutual funds or index funds. We buy a whole lot of companies with our 401ks. So we don't really care. I don't even know which companies I'm invested in, let alone care how they're being run. So you have all of us who are very quiet, passive, rationally apathetic. There's a kind of big term that's thrown out there. So we're rationally apathetic. And so it allows these, you know, these noisy shareholders to have a lot of influence over what companies do. And that's, you know, another big conversation about, well, what is the role of these activist investors? Do they have too much power now with, you know, all of these brand name companies you and I know, Apple, Pepsi, Procter & Gamble? I mean, they're all being targeted. So having said that, it doesn't mean that the power of shareholders is an absolute thing. There have been shareholders who've tried to kind of boss their way into companies and through the courts tried to tell companies, executives, and directors what to do. You should do it my way because I'm a shareholder. I own shares in the company. And that hasn't always worked. So now we're going to listen to a piece that I reported on a lawsuit that actually didn't work from a shareholder who owned a couple of shares of the Chicago Cubs ball club who wanted to make a change, and he failed.
Ernie Banks grounded out his first time. Banks hitting 263.
In 1966, 20-something lawyer Bill Schlensky got sick of seeing his Chicago Cubs lose. So he sued, since he owned a few shares of the team.
My father gave them to me as a gift.
We caught up to him in retirement in Texas.
It must have been before I was 4 or 5 years old.
The Cubs had gone 58 years without a World Series title. Perhaps it was a curse, or bad manager, or a bad business model.
Hey! Ball two, strike two.
Schlensky argued the Cubs didn't make enough money because they played in the day when people were working. Wrigley Field then was the only big league ballpark that didn't have lights. So he sued the ball club directors.
The directors have a responsibility for producing the most income for the shareholders.
Before the court, Schlensky argued that Cubs players struggled to adapt to the night games on the road.
When the Cubs had a homestand of more than 10 games, all-day games, the first game they played on the road, they generally lost.
The main defendant, team owner Philip Wrigley. His side may be best represented by this limerick by Valparaiso law professor and part-time poet Jeremy Telnin.
As Wrigley explained to the court, pro ball is a daytime sport. Next, they'll sell whiskey down at Comiskey, where the team's out for profit cavort.
The owner won. Telnin says this ruling underscores a key principle called the business judgment rule.
Courts, for the most part, defer to the decisions of the board of directors and dismiss actions by shareholders.
He says company directors enjoy broad protection, at least against little shareholders like you and me.
Institutional shareholders have more options. They can just threaten to sell their shares, and that can bring management to the table.
In the end, the Cubs got their lights in 1988, after threats by TV broadcasters, among others.
Let there be!
Vindicating plaintiff Bill Schlensky and Professor Telnin. See, he's from Chicago, too.
If the Cubs win the World Series this year, which they almost certainly will, we should all drink a toast to Mr. Schlensky. The Cubs wouldn't have been viable economically if they didn't start playing night games.
FYI, the Cubs next play tomorrow at home. Day game. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Thanks to Scott for joining us. You can check out the rest of our series at priceofprofits.org. And that's our show for this week.
Next week, we're continuing our conversation about the money lessons that you teach your kids. Have a lesson of your own? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. And Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.